Welcome to Watching Silent Films. My name is Yifeng, and with me I'm my co-host Lily. And Diane, greetings.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
This week, what we do in this podcast, we watch a film or series of shorts, and we talk about it. That's what we do on podcasts. And this week we've picked Der Rosenkavalier, which is The Night of the Rose, in 1925. That's when they were in production, but it was released in 1926. It's the final entry into Robert Wien's filmography that we have access to. Let's put it that way. I am not sure if there are probably most likely more films that aren't available on YouTube or things that are accessible to people that's running in film festivals. But beyond that, at least for the purpose of our podcast, we've come to the end of his filmography, of the list of films that's accessible to us. So, and what a final movie entry.
we'll get to that.
Yeah, and before we get to that, though, let's just do a real quick what we've been watching. Anything you guys seen in the last couple of weeks that would be constitutes a sort of a classic movie in the classic realm, I call it.
I feel like I just watched something recently, but nothing to the extent of it being a classic, of course.
Ugh. Well, last week I know we talked about Hitchcock, and so I watched a couple of Hitchcock films, and that was last week. The one that I really enjoyed was...
You mean since last week? You've seen additional Hitchcock films?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that was just last week. But I did like Black Mail very much.
I see. Yeah, I was thinking in the interim since we were recorded or...
No, haven't had time. Life has just been rushing by.
Yeah, likewise. Same here. I'm sure I've seen... I feel like I watched something and I just can't remember now. It's the problem I have, is I often just not remember the details of whatever it is. Oh, you know what I watched? It's more of a modern classic, is the, I can't remember yet, mid-80s, David Cronenberg's The Fly, which is a remake of the 1950s The Fly.
Help me! Black and white.
How's that?
Help me!
Well, have you seen either, or...
The 50s one version.
Yeah. That's a lot tamer, that's for sure.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
The 80s one is basically over the top. So it's just incredibly gory. So if you're...
Is it a slasher film? I've heard of it. I've never watched it because obviously a fly, ew, gross. No.
Well... I don't remember if I fully watched the old black and white. I may have seen bits and pieces of that. I really can't remember. But the premise, I think, is the same for both movies, which is that a guy figured out how to teleport between one pod and another. And he teleported himself. And then a fly got in and then basically spliced his gene together.
Ugh.
And so he became, in his genetic makeup, sort of like... half man, half fly hybrid. At least that was more the 80s version.
I've dated guys like that before.
That is a classic for sure, Diane. That line is a classic. But yeah, it was a great movie. It's just, but that's normal for David Cronenberg. His almost all of his film, not every, but a big chunk of his filmography is just really gory, and he is obviously trying to communicate something, but it's just it's not for everyone, that's for sure. So,
oh, Jeff Goldblum's in it. Okay, yeah. Gina Davis.
Think I'm not a big 80s movie fan. I mean, I should be, but I'm not. I don't think I was watching a lot of movies in the 80s, but I think that was one of the films that basically made his career. I mean, he's had a lot more movies afterwards, but for him, that was his calling card, I think, for a while. So that really catapulted him from whatever he was doing before. Best as I understand. But anyway, I would still consider that a classic. I mean, that's already, what is that, like 40 years ago now, I think. Is it 40? Let me see.
It no, one, says, two, three. One, 86. Two,
30 years. So 30-something years. Yeah.
And I don't want to say it, but I'm going to. Time flies.
Oh, yes.
I had to say it. I had to.
That's a zinger. Well, when you said the 80s, I guess something I did recently watch a few weeks ago, they had something about MTV because it's been about 40 years since it's been on the air. Technically, next year is its 40th anniversary. I don't know why they can never wait till the actual decade of the years. They have to do like one before it. So I watched that about MTV, which is the 80s. So yay, go me. It was interesting.
Yeah. Well, I was a big fan of MTV. So what did you think of it, Lily? Was it good?
I don't think Lily was born yet.
No, but I mean, I love 80s rock, you know, so it was just really interesting. I follow like Billy Idol on social media, so he posted something about it. So obviously they were talking about him on it. So I was like, oh, cool. I'll watch the MTV thing. So that's why I watched it. So I'm cool. But yeah, it was, you know, unique seeing it from the ground up. It was, you know, what they had to do to build it, because it was kind of a free-for-all, and then all these people came together, and then, you know, things happen, and they're like, why they're not playing certain artists, and then the company rules, and then getting thrown out, and then having to create the logo, just like unique stuff like that.
But did video kill the radio star?
I honestly couldn't tell you. Maybe YouTube did. But they said at the end, YouTube's great, because, you know, you can see any of these music videos at any time. But, you know, we don't have Ifong's giant-ass TV, so we can't see him at the grand scale.
Well, you know, it won't matter on a gigantic screen because the video quality was pretty poor in the 80s.
Yeah, that's so true.
Probably worse for compared to even some of the silent films that we watch, just because,
really?
I remember watching them
when they first debuted. Yeah, some of them were
pretty rough. Yeah, it's just... They use like VHS, VCR just to make those products, and those haven't aged well.
So, no.
Yeah. But anyway, so appears to be an 80s theme podcast, this one. Hopefully our movie is going to be very 80s like. In some ways it is.
It reminded me of Marie Antoinette, but I don't know. I think they made that film in the 90s with Kirsten Dunst. Maybe the 2000s. I don't know.
Yeah, that's much later. But yeah, so let's just get right into it. Again, Robert Wien's final film entry, 1926. And it was initially... I love the inception of the idea, which was that this particular film, The Night of the Rose, this work was originally an operetta musically written by Richard Strauss, who I don't know if people are even familiar with classical music in general, but he's basically been hailed traditionally as the successor to people like the Mozarts, the Beethovens, etc. I mean, those big names people know, but I think that the modern equivalent in which this film was contemporaries with in this work with Richard Strauss, and so having a work that was by him is, in my opinion, astronomical. But so he is the music sort of artisan for it, but it was the original operetta or libretto by Hugo Hofmannsthal, and he's the guy that sort of dreamed up all the stuff. I mean, he and Rich Strauss basically created this, and it was based on a novel. I don't know how I'm gonna pronounce this, but I'll try. It's a Louvre de Couvray, and it is a loose adaptation of that work, as well as another comedy, Molière's Monsieur de Korshutnek. Sorry if I'm butchering all of these names, but it was, you know, all, basically it's a mishmash of novels, comedian, stage work that created the stage comic operetta in three acts. And the initial inception of this is 1911, and it was first performed in the Königliches Opera House, which is in Dresden, one of the most popular, well-known opera houses really ever. But, you know, I'm not like an opera fan, so I don't really know all these details. I'm just reading from the Wikipedia. Mm. The initial direction was by Max Reinhardt, which we know because we've heard his name countless times before in relation to his innovation for German Expressionism, so especially on the stage. And of course, you know, his link with Robert Wien is Dr. Caligari, right? And Hansel Orlick and many other works of the Expressionism era. So it's no surprise that they all these groups of people, artisans, all know each other, right? So those parts aren't a surprise because they're all basically hanging around the same circles. But this film, basically the plot line of the film itself, it's hard to summarize because a lot happens in the film. But essentially, you've got basically something like a love triangle or more. And you've got, you know, it tackles multiple themes of like infidelity, parent and child sort of in marriage. And it just ultimately dealt with a lot of stuff. But the plot itself is pretty straightforward in the sense that you've got a prince and a princess who marry each other without sort of falling in love. It was kind of like a arrange, I guess. But the prince is off to war, and now the prince is by herself, and of course she has an affair with another character who is kind of like a womanizer, playboy character. And that particular character essentially is our main star of the title, the Knight of the Rose, that is him. And he falls in love with a girl that the prince's cousin is trying to marry and get rich off of. And so, you know, it essentially the hilarity ensues in terms of the rest of the plot line. A lot of back and forth. In fact, I feel like it's very Shakespearean. So anyways, so it's in terms of the theme of this film, I really felt like it was a grand departure from what Robert Wien normally tackles, at least based on the films that are available once again to us. I know you weren't there in the beginning when we were talking about this, Diane, but I know Lily was. We talked about Fear and even Caligari and Hansel Orlick and all these works. He, again, seems to be very focused on sort of the dark recesses of humanity and the impulses there. And in some ways, some of those themes are still here, but not in the shadows of the darkness, right? If anything, this film highlights that shadow and darkness on the interior character level, which is actually pretty amazing. So I would say that his tendencies towards those types of films he has basically departed of that. I was concerned in the beginning, Diane, basically saying like, well, I wish all of his films weren't like that, because I don't really think that most directors are one note type directors. They tend to sort of diversify their works and try to do new things. And so that was my fear in going in, because we had seen a string of them, right? Apparently those happen to be the ones that are preserved, at least as early works. But I would say starting with INRI, which is about essentially the Passion of Christ story, that was a big departure. And what was the last one before The Knight of the Rose? What was the one? Was there another one? No.
We did Fear, we did Knight of the Rose, we did Caligari, we did...
No, maybe it's just Hansel these two Orlock, then. I thought there was one more.
We did Yeah, I can't.
Oh, that was
Hitchcock.
Okay, sorry, that was totally different. So, yeah, so these two films makes me feel like he's probably done a heck of a lot more than this, and we just unfortunately have access to only a limited amount of film titles that he has. So, anyways, but so you kind of came into this towards the end of his filmography, Diane. So, what do you think about this one?
I was overwhelmed by it. I thought it was extremely well done. They talked last week when we, or the week before when we talked about INRI. They talked about the thousands of cast members that had to make up the film, and this film really did have thousands and thousands of people in it. It was just an extraordinary production. I think that it was done to the nth degree that it would be like a von Stroheim film, where you had realism in the costumes, in the way that people behaved. It was a fantasy, but it was extremely well done. I enjoyed the cast. I thought that it really was a comedy. You didn't have to go searching for the comedy in there. And it didn't hit you in the face, but it just went along in a very smooth fashion. But it did have some extremely funny moments in it, I thought. And it moved right along. It's not the shortest film in the world, but it kept me interested the entire time.
Hmm. I'd have to agree on that.
Yeah, Lily, what did you think of it?
Well, I compared it, even though I haven't seen it, they haven't seen Marie Antoinette, just that whole style of, you know, that time period, the big dresses, and, you know, the fancy outfits the men wore. I also enjoyed it just from watching all of Robert Wayne's other films. You know, this is quite different. I mean, I guess you could say in one sense, you know, the characters' minds are not deteriorating, but, you know, they're suffering internally because, you know, their lovers don't love them, or vice versa, and they love someone else. So we kind of see that type of psyche issues. But I mean, I also enjoyed it. It was long. Some parts I kind of lost connection with, like, what was going on, because the prince and the princess are together, and then she has her lover, and then he ends up going off with someone else, the girl Sophie, and then the princess finds out, and then like the prince finds out she's cheating on him. So it's just kind of like, you know, it keeps going on and on, but I think it's patched together pretty well. I don't know. It's not a faulty film. I mean, I'd like to see the musical, no, the opera, just to know about it. Because I know I've heard of Der Rosenkavalier before.
Oh, you have? Okay. I've never heard of
it. Yeah. It's like I never remember anything ever. What's the Carmen? Is that the other famous musical? Something like that? I don't know. It's like, I know of famous musicals. So, I don't know. I'm done.
Yeah, I mean, Carmen is a musical. Yeah, it's an opera.
Yeah, it's an opera.
Made into a silent film, made into a sound film.
Yeah,
it's been done over and over again.
Right.
And the music is so attracting. And so easy accessible, you find yourself humming Carmen without even realizing that you're doing it.
Right. It's I think it's in four acts.
Mm-hmm. That's what
French composer Georges Bizet. It's written by a bunch of people. But the point is, yeah, absolutely. I think I mentioned it earlier. It really, in terms of the story and plot line, reminds me a lot of the Shakespearean comedies. like A Midsummer's Night Dream, Twelfth Night, any of those, All's Well That Ends Well, Comedy of Errors, As You Like It, like this sort of prototypical characters miscommunicating and a ton of just really funny parts of just characters not really speaking what they're thinking and what they're feeling until something forces them in their character's lifespan to change or alter course. So all of that, just I found all of that incredible. So the actual opera for The Night of the Rose, debuted in 1911, which is about 15 years prior to this film. And it was done in three acts. Now, that story actually departs quite differently than this. Obviously, it's a lot more... It's obviously more theatrical and made for the stage. There are three separate acts and taking place in three separate scenes. The first one is just in the main princess's bedroom, and that's like act one. Act two is at the Sophie's sort of palace, the Von Fanenols, the guy who inherited the, was ennobled because of some political bureaucracy or something like that. So he's not like true aristocracy. That's act two. Sophie's the daughter who is the rose, the silver rose was presented to, the object of Octavian's objection, obsession. And the third one is the setup, right? At the ending where they basically set up the lecherous character, Oaks, and so on. So that's three separate acts, and they take place, and sort of different things happen in different parts of it. And I think the film does... shows a little bit more than those, the operetta, and then shows a lot more, especially towards the end, because the ending of the opera itself only has Octavian and Sophie having a happy ending. The rest of the other two couples didn't really receive anything. So that's the difference between this and the feature film. The differences. What I will say is, though, at the very end, I don't know if you guys noticed, when the music stopped and then you have that intertitle saying the last something like 10 or 15 minutes is lost.
Yeah, that was weird. It was just all of a sudden you're like, oh.
Oh, that, but that's, I can tell you, that's unfortunately very common. Not the last part, but just missing parts of film. And that
yes.
Films getting re... what's the word?
Readjusted?
Reconstituted, I don't know if there's
restored. Restored is the only.
Restored, yes, in terms of the film quality, but also like they basically put up the available footage that they have, and also still photography if they have the publicities, and then the intertitles if they have them. Basically, they strive to tell as much of the original story as possible. Given whatever they have left, they basically I don't know what the word I'm looking for, like reconstituted, yeah, for lack of a better term.
Like lemon juice. Actually, yeah. This was a lot sweeter than lemon juice. For me, when that moment happened and the screen went black and it was silent before they let us know that this was the end of the what existed, it cut it off completely. It really was kind of a shock. You really wanted to finish it. You wanted to see the end of it. And I think they handled it very well. I think that Strauss's music was superb. I think those little bits and pieces, because that's what it was, little bits and pieces that they found to wrap up the film, to give it some kind of fullness, it worked for me. It might not have worked for somebody else, but given all the grandeur of this particular costume picture, and it was really grand, I think that they pulled it off very, very well, because to set up an entire orchestra to restructure this, you know, to restructure this film was a magnificent act in itself. I think the orchestration was really wonderful. And that's really what fed the film for me as well. I know that Lily has said in the past, well, the music, you know, the music's not right. And I agree with her. The music's not right. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. This one was really good, though. It fit, you know, it just blended really well. They know what they're doing because they're watching the screen.
So, absolutely, all of that. I also want to, I don't know if you got my email, Lily, earlier, but I sent you a video of the 2001 Space Odyssey.
I did see it, but I didn't look at it.
But did you hear the score?
No, not yet.
Okay, if you listen to it, like, you'd immediately recognize it because so many of Strauss's themes is still being used in terms of for many, many things, whether it's advertisement or the current media. He, like I said, because he's the successor for all those classical composers, he likes to utilize very romantic type themes in terms of classical music. And there's a thing called the leitmotif, which is like this ability to have very strong melodies for his music that just it lends itself naturally to film and storytelling. And that's why it was a great match between him and not just the operetta, but this particular film, even though I read another review of like an opera review that reviews operas professionally. Mm-hmm. They kind of turned their nose at the film because, of course, their bias is they want everybody to see the stage itself, right? But I would say that he kind of, the composer Strauss, revolutionized even modern music, especially if you talk to Max Steiner and Bernard Herrmann and all of those people who did like stuff like Gone with the Wind and Casablanca and many, many classic film scores all the way through like John Williams. You know that name at least, right? Like mm-hmm. the theme of Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
They all used his technique, the notion of the leitmotif, like da 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 da, like, it's so melodic, it's so memorable, it's so strong, and that allows the person enjoying that piece of artwork, whether it is an opera or the film medium or now TV, but in radio and on and on and on, whatever you're watching, that story allows, basically the music draws you into it and allows the emotions to take weight. And that's his contribution, I think, not to just this work, The Night of the Rose, but to all of the music that we know of now in terms of modern classical music, highly influential. I'm not saying he's the be-all and end-all and on everything, because there are definitely others, but his influence is pretty great, especially when it comes to film music and melodies of film scoring and music. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So super fascinating too.
Yeah, and so it is why the music is like so amazing in when you transition scenes. It has different themes for different characters, even though that snooty opera review said that it's basically a hodgepodge, a collection of all his previously performed works, which is true because he already did the work for the operetta itself. So we're taking kind of the bits and pieces of it, and it is being reorchestrated for the film by another person, seems like.
It's like the comment I made last week about the film critics making critiques about film. It's like, well, do you do film or do you just talk about film? Shut up and get in there and figure it out. You know, because obviously they're going to be like, oh, it's, you know, pish posh. It's like, right. Well, are you writing amazing scores? No, shut up.
But my point is, I think, to me personally, the film itself, because of the music and the way it's all put together, I've never heard of it. I haven't seen it before, but it's one of the best silent films I've ever seen. It's at that height, and because of things that Diane talked about. Because the thing about silent films is, you're right, Lily. It it ultimately really is about how the music influences you. It's really half the movie, you know. And if you've got a great score, especially like this one from a master of like great, you know, classical music composition that innovated in his era, well, it's already half won. But above and beyond that, one of the things that I really enjoy about this film was not just the story and not just sort of operatic, quote-unquote, acting and all those different things, but also that it really takes you through everything. You've got, like, you know, it starts with the character, all about the character, and then some of the story and backgrounds that the characters take you through. But then it goes to, like, the prince winning the war in victory, and that, even though it was only like a few minutes long, that scene, it was tremendous. Like that whole war scene, who knew like Robert Wynn could pull that off? Because a great chunk of this film had a lot of exteriors, which I was shocked by, because I would assume, like many of his previous films, he would do interior and control all the sets, right, and the lighting and everything. But there's so much exterior to this film, right? Lots of nature, lots of sun, ocean, mountains, waters, lots of hills, lots of battles. It's a sweeping epic drama, right? You talk about epics. This is one of the epics of the silent era. There were many, right? But this is coming towards the tail end of it. And it, I mean, I haven't seen it, but it's probably going to be something like the Abel Gance's Napoleon. You know, have you seen that one, Diane? Or you,
oh, yes. Heard about it, right? Absolutely.
You've seen the 7-hour cut? Or 5 hours?
I've seen the 5-hour cut. It gets, they find more and more and more of it. And it's a magnificent film. Absolutely magnificent.
But do you know what I'm talking about when I reference that? Because I feel like that segment where the prince is at war reminds me a lot of that feeling, right? When you watch a scope, an epic scope like that, right?
Well, I was too busy concentrating on the storyline that was happening in the palace and the palace grounds. And basically, at least this is just from my perspective, that, you know, while her husband is becoming famous in the war, and that's sort of like he goes off, you know, and they show some of the war. I wasn't overwhelmed by that aspect of the film because the story was still taking place at the palace where everybody else was partying hardy. And it's like one gigantic ball is what it is. And with a lot of little sub-stories that are going on inside of it. You've got a masked ball. You've got love affairs happening in little rooms and corners. And then you've got the comedy that weaves its way through all of this plot that's going on. It was just an all-over. It was a beautiful film. The war scenes itself did not really catch my eye so much as I was watching for soldiers to die. I know that sounds weird, but, you know, when you
well, I understand.
Shooting yeah. going on and all that sort of thing.
What I meant to communicate is that the scope of the film wasn't just limited to, like, the palace intrigue. What I mean to say is that it included other things, too, that expanded the scope of the story that I don't think was in the original operetta, right?
Right.
So I think that's the beautiful thing about this film is that it was possible to not just have the characters having intricate, sort of complicated relationships in sort of the aristocratic society, but it's aristocracy rather. But rather just the whole expansion of the scope of the storyline is that all of a sudden you got this prince's, he's been like out of the picture for a long time, and all of a sudden he cuts to his struggles and his things, and all of a sudden he wins a victory, and he doesn't even I think the purpose of that is to show the grandeur of the epic and hundreds of soldiers, right, just for a few minutes of film. But also once all of that is done and he doesn't feel like the victory wasn't a victory in his mind, even though it was good for his professional career, it didn't feel like his life was, it felt like his own personal life was falling apart. And so he was like, that's why he was like, victory, victory, victory. And then he was like, give me a coach to Vienna straight away. He really needed to come home. And part of the ratcheting up that drama was basically saying, what's he going to do when he gets home? You know what I mean?
He was a stiff character to me, though.
Right.
In comparison to the other characters in the film. And I was waiting for him to sort of come back into the scene and become part of the intrigue, as you say. But he never did. He never really did do that. We were already taken away by all the sex hormones that were flying around that castle. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like over the, they seemed to hold sway over the whole, their whole world. But that's just what I...
Yeah, I mean, I believe he was simply a plot device to get to the ending. He wasn't, I think that specific character wasn't the original operetta, and that's why he wasn't as fully developed compared to all the other characters, right?
Right.
So he wasn't even there, and so he's kind of an add-on. And that's what happens when you try to pad some of the story. But be that as it may, I greatly enjoyed it. Like you said, when the ending came, it was a shock and a surprise. And like you said, I also enjoyed the ending, the reconstructed ending. Reconstructed. Maybe that's the word I was thinking. But you know, Diane, you can speak a little bit into that. It's like, for a lot of silent films, large and small, or known or unknown, it's very common to have reconstruction.
Entire films, right? Entire right. Films have been reconstructed. Greed, completely reconstructed. Not completely, because we don't have 40 reels of reconstruction, but through photographs and camera angles and music. I was very satisfied with the reconstruction of Greed. I don't know if other people were. But that's going to be one of those films that we will never see the whole thing. It was just, it's to the four winds, whatever's missing. And if we do find it, because I need to be optimistic about these things, I will certainly be pleased. They did the same thing with London After Midnight. They had hundreds of photographs, and a gentleman by the name of Rick Schmidlin, who worked on Greed, also worked on London After Midnight, starring Lon Chaney, and used the photographs to try to reconstruct the film, but it still fell short. It was also known not to be that great of a Chaney film, but I was much more satisfied with Greed and what he was able to do with that. He worked with a lot. There is another gentleman, his name is Philip Dye, and he wanted to reconstruct Theda Bara's Cleopatra, which is one of the most sought after lost silent films today, and which people get very excited over, even if they see one photograph from that film. And he wasn't able to do it, unfortunately, even with the hundreds of stills that he was able to procure. So he had to turn it into a book, which, you know, fell short of his dream, which is a shame, because it was beginning to build with what he had. But he didn't make it. But he had to do something with all the hours that he had put into, and all the time and effort that he had put into restoring or reconstructing, because there is a difference between restoring and reconstructing something, in my mind. I don't know about you.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing I was trying to get at, Lily, is that even quite a number of films we already reviewed on this podcast, there are many of those that have had reconstructed scenes. I believe one of the, I don't remember the name, but one of the shorts that we watched where him going up this swimming pool, and he dives and misses the pool and lands like straight through
that one.
The ground.
Was one of the Buster Keaton movies.
Buster Keaton, yeah, where he basically goes to China and comes back.
Hard luck. Kids. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's an example of like they hadn't found the lost footage, but they reconstructed it with stills and bits and pieces, and of course they ended up finding it years later, and then now it's in the media that we have. But the point is that reconstruction is a common thing with silent film, just because the virtue of how much volume of silent films are lost. And so on one hand, it did surprise me for this particular movie, Night of the Rose, but on the other, it didn't. So, but in either instance, and it was like, I thought to myself, well, of course it had to be the ending, right? Because the most, to me, the most important part, where you want to see how everything wraps up, which I think it sounded like it tied up like with a happy ending, this particular film.
I think it did.
Yeah.
I liked it. I don't need a downer at the end of a film.
Right.
Especially one like this that was meant to be a comedy in the first place.
Right.
It reminded me very much of, there were some scenes in there that reminded me of,
Mozart, right? This is by
Mozart, yeah. Yes. There's a scene in this particular film where they're doing a play on the stage, and it's
again, very Shakespearean, right? He does a lot.
Very Shakespearean, yes. And it's about the Baron being made fun of in his quest to be with a young woman, to marry a young woman and buy her from her father. And he recognizes that he's the one that's being japed. And but what's going on stage is absolutely hilarious to me. I thought that was one of the funnier aspects of the film, and it did remind me of the kind of plays that Mozart would do. Mozart wasn't just a serious composer; he was also a composer of comedy, opera as well, and so it still has that kind of flavor to it.
So yeah, I personally like this one far above Caligari, any of the other Robert Wing works that we have thus far seen. So it's got my vote for sure. Anyway, do you guys have any parting thoughts about it, or any additional thoughts?
Well, somebody really did their homework in the lives of the court. There was, besides the balls and the parties that were going on and the big picnics and the way that they entertained themselves, there was a lot of ballet going on in this. And this is the way that royalty entertained themselves. This was not for the common individual. This was royal stuff, and they trained in ballet, and they trained in different arts that was just for the royal families and the royal community. And I enjoyed the ballet that they were doing in one of the scenes of the, now that had a lot of people in it too. That was a scene of hundreds, maybe a few thousand people that was pulled off and very well done.
The aristocracy, right?
The aristocracy, yes. Yeah. And their life was really well done. I was gasping at the costumes. I thought the costumes were, absolutely.
They were phenomenal.
They were phenomenal. The wedding gown, supposed to be the wedding night for one of our characters, and that gown just, woo, I was just amazed. And all she got was a kiss on the hand because her husband had to leave to go to war by. And she had gotten all dolled up. I mean, more than dolled up. That gown was incredible in its creation. And that's what she had, who he had left behind was a woman in love and ready to start off in that world of sexual love and marriage. And it had to go someplace. So it went to
all the
hero.
Costumes were amazing. Absolutely.
Yes, they were. That's why I was talking about von Stroheim's films, where he liked to get the costumes just right.
Right.
Right down to their underwear. And that's where he got in trouble.
But it's true, though. You have to get the petticoats right. You have to get every fine detail, because if it's off, hey, someone's going to know, because I'm sure there were quote-unquote nerds back then, too. Or, you know, enthusiasts of that culture.
In that time, it was, I think, to transition from, I mean, there's still aristocracy today, like, you know, England and a bunch of other European countries, I'm sure. There's still some kind of left in the world. Largely bygone, of course, now. But in the earlier 20th century, there were a whole lot more. I think a lot of countries were changing from the aristocratic society into a more democratic type, and due to revolutions and on. So politically, there were a lot of things that were changing, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were still a fair number of people. Maybe they might know some of these specific things. Like, I remember the scene in this film where, because the Fennel family, the dad and Sophie, they were new to aristocracy, so they didn't know all the details. And so they had to have a guy come in and say, you would curtsy this way, and somebody is going to present the rose. And exactly 11 minutes later, you know, coming with the bridegroom, like, all these details to tell them, like, they had to be told what to do and what those social mores were, because they didn't know. They've been granted these things. And so, like, that little detail was pretty significant. This actually all reminds me of Luciano Visconti, the director and artisan for a bunch of movies, Italian movies, about royalty and aristocracy. The Leopard, 1963. What was the other one he did that I saw? The Leopard, definitely. Oh, Senso. I think Senso. 1954? It's got to be this one. Yeah, that one. Yeah, there's a couple of Italian historic dramas where this director, Luciano Visconti, would make about a lot of which is the passing of aristocracy, aristocratic society, into sort of the modern era. And these stories were about these aristocrats and how they were going to live through these transitions. What's interesting is he himself was aristocracy who made that transition. So he put a lot of his personal life, Leehood, into some of these films that he made about the loss. He's got a nostalgia for aristocracy. So in some sense, this movie reminds me, of course, this is much earlier than the films that he was making, which, again, wouldn't surprise me if this film influenced his stuff. history, right?
Tell me if I'm right or wrong. Was Strauss, the opera took place, but Strauss created the opera 15 years before the film and produced it 15 years before the film came out. Was he involved at all in the music for the film itself?
Oh, I think so. Richard Strauss, yeah. Yeah, these are all original scores of his.
But he was involved in the film.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
That's what makes it really special.
Yeah.
That's what makes it very, very special. in addition to, I mean, this was his baby all the way. Yeah. And he was even willing to take it to the screen. George Bernard Shaw didn't want to take his films to the screen. He just wanted to stay on the written page. And, but he was convinced, by, which was
Gabriel
based
Pascal.
On Gabriel Pascal. Thank you very, very much. Now I can sleep tonight. How much, GBS would have hated the ending of, My Fair Lady in compared to Pygmalion, which was much truer to what he wanted to get across in his story. And that was a 1938 film with, my mind, it's melting. Leslie Howard playing, Professor Higgins, and Wendy Hiller playing, Liza Doolittle. So there, I got my mind back together. So that's exciting to me that Strauss was involved in the silent film. That to me makes it richer and better. And it just wasn't something that was separate from a work that he did 50 years before the film came out. It's a G.B. Shaw kind of thing too, where he was involved in allowing somebody else to take his films or to take his stories and put them on the screen, which I can really appreciate.
In fact, that opera house at Dresden, Simpor Roper, that opera house is where the initial debut of the operetta, like that was the initial place where the operetta itself debuted. So the operetta itself debuted at this opera house, which is why I kind of made a point to highlight that in Dresden with the creator Hoffman and also the Hoffmannsthal, and also who wrote the work in terms of the written story and page and stuff like that.
The
actual music.
Yes.
But the music itself was by Richard Strauss, and he was there conducting that in 1911 when they debuted and premiered that whole thing. And now 15 years afterwards, again, 1926 in January, they premiered the film with Robert Wien and all the company. So they did it the same exact place, but instead of a play, operetta, it's now a film. And he was there at the premiere. In fact, the tidbit, I guess, trivia, is that the music during the film's performance was provided by an orchestra at the premiere. This was conducted by Strauss himself. The film's projection speed had to be adjusted by the projector in order to fit the speed of the orchestra, because I guess this is I'm not a fan of, you know, Strauss. I mean, I don't listen to his stuff, like, you know, on Spotify regularly.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that of what I read, Strauss tends to like his music's fast. Like, he likes to play even old material like at super speed. And so that it would explain the problem here. The film's projection speed has to be adjusted by the projector in order to fit the speed of the orchestra. This task fell to the film's cameraman, Hans Andersen, because only he knew the exact length of each scene and cut. In later performances, a special recording, also conducted by Strauss, provided the music. Strauss conducted the Vienna and London premieres and recorded excerpts for the film score from the film score on the Victrola label at that time. A planned tour of the United States in 1927 by Strauss and his orchestra failed to go ahead because of the emergence of sound films. So, there you have it. It's quite interesting. And of course, you know, it has done a few premieres, you know, since then. And if you watch the recording on the DVD, which captured a performance, a reconstruction of the film and performance, and I don't know who the conductor is, but I don't remember. But there's a DVD recording of that event itself, which is from the late 2006, 2008, sometime like that. So the DVD, again, went to the same opera house and again debuted the film many decades later.
Wow, I love again, that.
So they did the same exact thing, which is why I really enjoyed it, because it really felt like you put yourself... I love that they capture the event. It's not so much that the film, which was great too, but it really felt like a concert to me, because if you listen to the score on the 08-06 reconstruction, it really felt like you were listening to it. It was live. So they recorded that performance like live. So I love that. Because, you know, like I was saying, trying to make a point earlier, silent films, you really have to treat them like a concert. And if you've ever been to any concert, every concert is a unique experience unto itself. It only happens, even if the same band plays, you know, 100 shows, I'm making it up, but if they play 100 shows in a year, every one of those 100 shows is a unique experience, right? That, you know, person A, even if person A attends like two of those, no two concerts are the same, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same with silent films, is you could watch the same movie with two separate performances, even if it is by the same band, but it would be two separate experiences, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, because especially if you have two different accompanists, you know, they're going to see things differently, and I don't know, maybe...
No, what I'm saying is, even if it's the same accompanist, if this everything is the same exact thing, it's still concert, like a band concert.
It depends on the energy of the crowd, exactly, too, if they're into the film or not. Yeah, it's the same thing with any theater performance.
Yeah. And, you know, I think... You, Diane, probably have attended a lot more live performances of silent films than I have. I've only been to a handful, I'm sure.
I can't. If you think they're wonderful, they are wonderful.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. There's no... nothing to compare to having live music with a film. It's its own art form.
Even separate and apart from modern movies, I feel like that's why I often use that analogy, that it is kind of like live concert. Essentially, it really is a musical performance that you attend live in conjunction with the film. That entire thing is an experience. And if you can, you know, it is always great to be able to attend those to gain an appreciation for silent films.
That's right. Very, very exciting. Very exciting. I feel bad now that we're in the COVID that a lot of people do not have access to seeing the films that way in this time, because it's such a grand, wonderful, inexplicable, can't even explain it, how wonderful it is.
Actually, Bob and I were originally planning to go to Metropolis, the Complete Cut performance with the Alloy Orchestra, with their particular modernized score, which I really enjoyed. In April, of course, it got canceled.
Right, so, yes.
Unfortunately, yeah.
That would have been wonderful.
It would have been, yes.
Where was that going to be? Was that in Boston?
Yeah, that was going to be in Beverly. Yeah, I was actually trying to acquire tickets for it. I did text you, but I think you were busy that night, that particular evening or something.
Probably, yeah. Because I would have gone. I mean, I know 128, you know, obviously since working in Salem. So I would have been like, yes.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that, you know, unfortunately we're in this sort of pandemic situation. But if it weren't for that, I just think that any performances of silent films is worth going to. Even like the worst ones is still worth going to, because it's that connection of like live music and a film. There's some sort of a strange alchemy that occurs when you can enjoy a silent film that way. That's, again, totally unique for this silent film era, compared to even modern music, modern score and modern films. Anywho, I think we could probably go on, but this is, to me, is an amazing piece of film, especially the live performance capture, like we were just talking about. And, it's almost unfathomable that I would see something of his, Robert Wayne's, surpass Dr. Caligari, but here we are. I really do enjoy the comedy and the drama and the different sort of highs and lows and the different characters ebb and flow in this particular work. And also the music and score rendition were astonishing, setting up the stage for film scores for decades to come, ultimately.
It was pretty darn close to a live performance for me.
Yeah, it really felt like a modern movie in many ways. It didn't, especially with Robert Wayne's technical abilities, just didn't feel like it was a movie from the 1920s. Like, it really felt closer to something that was in my lifetime. At least that's how I enjoyed it. Even with the reconstruction of the ending. Because
I thought was beautiful.
Yeah, even with that, I feel like that it taps into your imagination a lot more, which I really enjoyed. How you would like in your imagination connect the dots. There are, Lily, by the way, entire films reconstructed with still photography and intertitle text, and that's it. That they have zero footage of the film. Like,
that's crazy.
Yeah, like F.W. Murnau's The Four Devils is a movie that he made in the Hollywood studio system because he was from Germany, and this is post the rise of the Nazi, and he basically bailed, and now he's in the U.S., so he's made a bunch of movies, but he made this one called The Four Devil, and it's supposed to be an amazing piece of work. But it's lost to time so far. But they've done a 90-minute reconstruction using stills. There's a huge amount of production stills and publicity photos and scripts and so on. So they reconstruct, and I loved it. Even though it's reconstructed and I know it, I use my imagination. It was almost like I watched the movie. I didn't, but it was like, you know what I mean? So
yes.
Yeah. All right, I wrote that down, so I'll check it out. Do we know if it's on YouTube or?
I know it was part of a DVD because I have the F.W. Murnau's DVD. So one of the movies has that. I don't know if it's on YouTube or anywhere. But anyways, I'm just using that as an illustration that's the desire of so many silent film fans is that they want to see these movies, but they're not available. And in lieu of that, the reconstruction's sometimes better than nothing at all.
Right.
So.
Well, with this film, you know, at the very end, like we were saying, especially the prince's character, I feel with him not being seen with outside of those stills, you know, it kind of summed up what he did anyway, which is not much. You know, that's his most bold move when he's fighting the other guy, Octavian, I think is his name. But it's just, you know, because it's in a still frame. I don't know. I kind of felt like, oh, okay, good enough. Just because he was kind of the plot device.
Right. I thought he was going to kill him because I've never seen or read about the play, so I didn't know how it was going to end. So it felt like he was on the path because he's, you know, a seasoned soldier and, you know, aristocrat who uses a sword for fun is not going to beat a seasoned soldier, right, who's now a general or something. Mm-hmm. And so I really thought he was just going to kill him outright. That'd be the ending.
I mean, I would say we never know, but we do know how it ends because the intertitle card told us, oh, they get all together. Yay.
Yeah, happy endings for all.
Happy endings. Yeah. Yay.
All right. Any parting thoughts? I mean, it's a beautiful film. I really enjoyed it. It one of my favorites, for sure.
I'm with you.
Yeah, I would watch this one again. Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe on a bigger screen, or just in a way that you can kind of respect it a little more. You know, we only can view them so well, depending on our viewing devices. I mean, obviously, I didn't watch this on my phone, but then that way you can just get more of the experience of the sound matching with what's on screen.
Yeah. But also, I think that there's... I think there's something epic about this film. Obviously, the big screen works too. But there, I think the key here is the music component. It's so unique to this film. I can't think of any other silent film that has a world-class, well-renowned, like Mozart, Beethoven level composer composing original score for. I just can't think of any other silent films. Do you know of any?
This is pretty unique.
Yeah, I can't think of any other silent films where the composer is this like Mozart, Beethoven level guy who is just out of this world amazing, you know, that wrote the scores for it.
True, you don't really hear like geniuses, musical geniuses anymore.
Yeah. So, there are so many other maybe tangents of stories that we could explore, like the guy who plays the cousin of the princess, Oaks or something.
Oh, the Baron Oaks.
Oaks, yeah. So he, in real life, is actual and a real life opera singer. And if you look at the behind the scenes stuff or read a little bit into it, all of the they basically filmed this movie like the operetta. So the actors, they weren't actually just dialoguing. They were actually basically performing and singing all of their parts.
That's funny. Amazing. I didn't notice the singing part.
Yeah, so if you watch it again, I knew that beforehand, and so I was astonished. It's such a minor detail, but once you watch it again, you'll notice everybody's basically singing it. Like that letter carrier in the beginning going to Oaks's estate, that he wasn't just yelling or bellowing, he was singing like at the top of his lungs his part.
Okay, that's what he was. I was very confused by, you know, what he was doing with his mouth. I was just like, are you hollering? What are you doing?
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Yeah. And they were all doing that basically. They were performing essentially the operetta. That, you know, that's how the great directors do it. They do go for authenticity, even though they know at that point in time that they weren't going to record that audio portion and attach it to the final product. They still did it.
I saw a live performance of Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney several years ago, and there's a part for...
Like on video, right? Not in person, right?
No, this was in person. I saw this staged... it was a live performance, and in the film there is a soprano who sings an aria, and they brought a live soprano on stage to sing the part, to sing her part in the film.
Right.
And it was absolutely amazing the way they were able to pull that off and sync it together. And it just turned it into a 3D experience.
Right. You watched a capture playback of the original performance, right? You didn't attend a physical performance with Lon Chaney, is my question.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. No. No, I'm not that old.
That's what I figured.
Yeah. Now, this was a wonderful evening that I had many years ago that I will always treasure. It was one of those unique evenings that you can't redo. You got to be there.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying. I'm really glad that somebody preserved that performance of the score for this film. You know, doing everything
absolutely
right, essentially.
Yes.
So. But anyways, I was trying to go, you know, we're not going to dig into it, but there are, that character, the Oaks character in real life was a opera singer who actually roomed up with, basically they all... sort of all of these artisans and creators involved with this film and many others because of the where they're at in that, you know, German Australian not Australian Austrian region, they've all had to contend with the rise of Hitler and Nazism and how they reacted to the regime. you know, because some of them actually just stayed behind and lived through everything instead of just leaving the region and the area and coming back to it. So anyways, so they all have had different sort of responses to sort of what happens, you know, in that area. Anyways, but we don't have to get into it.
Well, I feel I must dance a wall, sing an aria, and find a lover at the same time. That's what it makes me feel like.
Yes. Yes. Anywho, so that's our take on it. If you guys have any parting thoughts, if not, we can wrap up the podcast. Do you guys have any parting thoughts other than what we communicated?
The good ending for a Robert Wien adventure.
Yes. I like doing that because then they're like, I mean, as far as at this time of recording, it feels good to complete something. I think it's good to complete going through his filmography and kind of checking that box off. At least it does for me. So, all right, cool. So that concludes our podcast for today. And thank you, listeners. Thank you, Lily and Diane. And you can find more of our stuff at watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. Again, that's watchingsilentfilmsplural.wordpress.com. And you can send us an email at watchingsilentfilms@gmail.com. Please leave a rating or a review on our Apple Podcast platform or anywhere you find our podcast. You can find more of Diane's stuff at the Silence Plural Majority Wayback Machine as a Facebook group. Just for a search for that, and you'll see a bunch of very interesting throwback to the silent era. And that's all we have for this week. So thanks again, listeners. Thank you again, Lily and Diane. This episode was produced by Lily and edited by Fong. Bye-bye.